This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. When Donald Trump claimed in 2015 that Mexican immigrants will ravage our women, destroy our neighborhoods, and taint our ethnic and cultural purity, he entered into a long-standing, well-cultivated American tradition of xenophobia and fear-mongering. In the late 19th century, poet Emma Lazarus celebrated the huddled masses yearning to breathe free and the wretched refuse who came to America for a better life. But Prescott Hall, the co-founder of the powerful Immigration Restriction League, offered a rebuttal verse. "Enough, enough, we want no more of ye immigrant from a foreign shore. Already is our land o'errun with toiler, beggar, thief, and scum." After a century of mostly open borders in which tens of millions of European immigrants became Americans, members of the WASP establishment decided in the 1920s that the United States could no longer accept what they denounced as beaten men from beaten races. In terms that will sound familiar today, Jews, Italians, and others, they claimed, were incapable of assimilating into a country based on private property, limited government, and hard work. In 1924, the restrictionists won a massive and long-lasting legislative battle with passage of the Johnson-Reed Act, which completely prohibited immigration from Asia and sharply limited immigration from Europe based on the country of origin. Under the new law, for instance, just 4,000 Italians were allowed to enter the country each year, down from an average well above 200,000 in each year of the preceding decade. National origins would remain the basis of U.S. immigration law until 1965. The guarded gate, bigotry, eugenics, and the law that kept two generations of Jews, Italians, and other European immigrants out of America, a new book by Daniel Okrent, looks at the ways in which xenophobia and pseudoscience combined to fundamentally alter immigration policy at the start of what became known as the American century. Okrent was the first public editor of the New York Times and is the author of Last Call, A History of Prohibition. He sat down with Reason to talk about how old debates over immigration and America's national character are newly relevant to contemporary politics. Daniel Okrent, thanks for talking to Reason.
It's my pleasure.
Okay. And before we get started, I do want to say up front, if we don't make a lot of sense, it's because you're descended from Polish and Romanian Jews, so we can't expect better.
It's amazing
from
you even let me into your.
And my mother's family is from outside Naples, and you quote people talking about Neapolitans as a degenerate class that were infected with spiritual hookworm, displaying a distressing frequency of low foreheads, open mouths, weak chins, poor features, and backless heads. So, you know, you've been warned. Give me the elevator pitch of your book.
Beginning in the middle of the 1890s, when the immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe was accelerating, and Ellis Island was almost overwhelmed with people coming in, and the slums began to grow in the large city of the Northeast, a very, very strong anti-immigration movement began. For 20 years, some very well-connected people, both in Congress and out, passed laws, and four times presidents vetoed those laws that would have limited immigration from those countries to some degree. Then in 1916, something was dropped in their lap, which was a book called The Passing of the Great Race by a really interesting and scary character named Madison Grant. And that brought the two things together. He brought the eugenic idea, which had been developing since Darwin, really, over the preceding 60 years. And he connected that to the anti-immigration feeling and said, these races are genetically inferior. And so suddenly, the anti-immigration people, they had science on their side. They weren't bigots.
And then in 1917, they were able to pass the first kind of major literacy
test. Well, they passed in 1917 the literacy test, and it's vetoed. Right. And then they pass it over the veto. But by that time that had happened, this literacy test that was meant to keep out the uneducated people of the Eastern and Southern European countries, their education levels in those countries had begun to increase. So it wasn't enough to use illiteracy as the excuse to keep them out. They needed another excuse. And the American scientific establishment, coming from the greatest institutions in the country, provided them with this excuse, and it was junk science.
We'll get to that in a second. I mean, it's an incredible slugger's row of, you know, everybody in America. I mean, it's Eleanor Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, obviously, W.E.B. Du Bois. All of them were anti-immigrant and or eugenicists. But set the scene a little bit in the late 19th century. Who is coming to America and in what numbers? And why?
Well, the immigration from Europe begins to change around 1870, 1880, it begins to accelerate. There are two key drivers of this. One is the desperate poverty in southern Europe, particularly in southern Italy and Greece and part of the Slavic countries. And in the northeast part of Europe, the incredible anti-Semitism, the pogroms against the Jews, the racial laws that confined Jews to living in certain areas, kept them out of certain occupations, limited the amount of education they have. So people from these two areas really have an impetus. They have a reason to want to live, to leave. And then they're handed the ways, the means of doing it, which is a transcontinental railroad network. Mm. You know, before the railroads crisscrossed Europe, for somebody who lived in a shtetl in eastern Poland to get to a port was a really difficult thing, but now it could be done.
Who has already been excluded from America? Because it's an interesting kind of backstory.
And absolutely. You know, it goes in a cycle in this country. And it's, we are the land of the free, keep out. We are the land of the free, keep out. It goes back to the 1750s when Benjamin Franklin wanted to keep Germans out of Pennsylvania. Then we're more open to it. Then the Irish come, and there's a very strong anti-Irish feeling efforts to keep them out that failed, and the Irish population grew very rapidly, of course. 1882 is probably the most horrible anti-immigration law in U.S. history, the Chinese Restriction Act, which absolutely limited the further immigration of any Chinese into the country. So there have been these cycles, and there have been other groups that have been kept out. Now suddenly it was these new ones.
What were the immigration restrictionists particularly afraid of? Because, they talk at great length, but what was their primal fear?
I think that it's as basic as that any group of people needs another group of people to hate, to look down on. But then it gets aggravated by the presence in their lives of people that they never expected to find in their lives. So in Boston, for instance, where the immigration restriction movement really took hold and it was sort of the heart of the restriction movement, in Back Bay, people are living in beautiful houses on Commonwealth Avenue. And less than a mile away were the horrible slums of the South End and the West End, the North End. These people are impinging on us, and what are they going to do, not only to our city and our country, but to our families? There's this terrible fear that has manifested, the fear manifests itself primarily in Teddy Roosevelt's presidency of intermarriage between the so-called Anglo-Saxon peoples and those from these other countries.
And the Anglo-Saxons eventually became Nordic, right?
Yeah, this was a coinage in the late 1890s that divided Europe into three racial groups. In fact, the first such division was stated by William Z. Ripley of MIT, and he said it was Teutonic, which were the German people who also spread into Scandinavia, into the UK, Alpine and Mediterranean. It was only when the Germans suddenly became our enemies in World War I did it change from German to Nordic, and that was the phrase that the term
and
stuck.
The Alpines then are kind of the French?
Yeah.
Obviously, these are bad categories.
It's messed up. Yeah. The French, primarily French Belgians, you could probably, the Austrians were cool. Maybe the Moravians, I don't know. It was a messy thing, but they adjusted these categories to suit their particular political needs at any given time.
So the immigration restrictionists have their fear, and a lot of it is about miscegenation or race mixing and things like that. What about the eugenicists?
The eugenicists begin with a very different program. It starts in England. Really comes right out of the Darwinian Revolution. 1859, Darwin publishes Origin of the Species, and suddenly the accepted view of the origins of mankind is thrown out, the view that today we'd call creationism. Once you realize that we're not all descended from Adam and Eve, then we are not all brothers, we are not all related, then you can have distinctions between people and you can look down on them as being genetically different. It's in fact a cousin of Darwin's, Francis Galton, a really interesting, strange character, a gentleman scientist, who coins the word eugenics and puts forth the idea that the UK can be improved if we can get the best to marry the best. His big idea was to have picked the 5,000 best young men, the 5,000 best young women, have them all married in one ceremony, arranged marriages, presided over by Queen Victoria in Westminster Abbey, and then pay them several thousand pounds a year so they could not have to work, they could just create babies.
Well, that's good work if you can get it, right?
Then it changes.
And he, well, he also coined the term nature and or nature versus nurture, nature and nurture.
Yeah, he takes that out of Shakespeare, actually, from The Tempest. But yeah, the basic arguments that have gone on forever, is it environment or is it genes? Right. That's really the
And he's very basic. Much then it's mostly genes.
Yeah, entirely genes. Although in his selecting the best people, he notices that not only do they come from the same families, they come from well-established families that have sent their kids to college and had private tutors and all the other things that the upper classes had. But the idea of negative eugenics is the one that becomes...
So talking about that, because positive eugenics is just the idea, we all kind of participate in some form of positive eugenics. You pick a mate that you like and you want to have kids with.
Right.
What's the negative?
The negative is to stop people you don't like from having kids. And that's obviously an oversimplification. But the first movement, the expression of eugenics was efforts to keep epileptics, the so-called feeble-minded, the blind, that congenitally blind, congenitally deaf, from reproducing. Because if we could weed those out of the population, we would have a better population.
So it's totally taken from livestock. And a big player in your book is the American Breeders Association, which is kind of like livestock, human. It's all the same.
A lot of the wealthy people who sponsored the movement, like Mary Harriman, Averill Harriman's mother and the widow of the railroad baron, she was a horse breeder, and she really, if you do this and this. Now, what they didn't realize and what the wiser geneticists knew, that it would take 250,000 generations to really get rid of all of these things.
And they're also, they're talking about breeding, but they don't really have, the genetic revolution hasn't happened yet.
Right. But they do know what they've been doing with their livestock, and they do know what they've been doing with plants.
And peas and stuff like this.
Well, the Mendel's peas, nobody paid attention to Mendel. Nobody knew he was even alive until 30 years after he was dead. And then around the turn of the century, the Mendelian revolution ties to this eugenic idea, and suddenly it's the hottest thing in science.
What about the pseudoscience? Because this is, you stress throughout the book that scientists know what they know, but then that often gets overturned. And we're not talking about marginal figures here, really. I mean, in some ways we are, but mostly this is a kind of scientific establishment in America, or very smart people at very big institutions, whether it's MIT or Stanford or the Museum of Natural History. What are some of the big instances where they just thought they were doing science, but it was just totally kind of bunkum?
Primarily had to do with the kind of investigation and testing that they did of those whom they had determined were genetically inferior. So Charles Davenport, who was the leading scientist, and he was a very, very accomplished and important animal geneticist, he then tiptoes into the world of humans, and oh my God, this is so exciting. We can apply the same principles to it, but let's go out and find out whether these people are genetically good or not. So they conduct, he gets college students on summer vacation, trains them for a week or two, and then sends them out to poor neighborhoods, sends them out to closed off parts of the world where people have been inbreeding, and they're to determine the genetic value of the human being who's there, they're interviewing, without any acknowledgement of what the environment has done to these people. So this was a fundamental error that was clear even at the time to the British eugenicists, who said, this is junk, don't pay attention to it. But it was so exciting for the Americans who wanted to put it to use.
Can you talk about the intelligence tests, particularly the early ones that are just egregious, and how they measured intelligence?
Well, any number of ways that you can look at it. there was one series of tests conducted by H.H. Goddard on Ellis Island, where they would pick people and put them through some basic kind of IQ tests, shapes and numbers and things like this. But they only picked the people who looked like they might be a problem. So all those, he's okay. He's speaking, pretty good. His sentences are fine. Well, let's test this guy. Well, what do you get from that? They found that 80% of the Jews were genetically deficient in their intelligence, 65% of Hungarians, 70% of Bulgarians. I mean, it was lunacy. And Goddard himself, he cut the numbers in half just arbitrarily because he couldn't believe them either. And then not too many years later, he recanted entirely. But the lie that travels around the world before the truth is found was the case here, too.
Virtually everybody in the book, going back to earlier days in American history up through, the early 30s, everybody was either, you know, first off, everybody hated Jews and Italians and or embraced eugenics. And I mean, the list of people, and this is incomplete, but it's Samuel Morse, the Telegraph guy, Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, Margaret Sanger, Calvin Coolidge, Woodrow Wilson, Eleanor Roosevelt, Charles Francis Adams, who was a great early deregulator, Samuel Gompers, the union leader, James J. Hill, the empire builder, Sidney Webb, H.G. Wells, Oliver Wendell Holmes. I mean, the list is virtually endless. Every page has another great American figure or British figure. What was going on that this, you know, that they were both anti-immigrant and eugenicists?
Well, that list is a mix of those two. Some of those people were just anti-immigrant. Right. Some were just anti certain kinds of immigrants. But it gets back to that notion of not letting somebody into my club. Until the mass migration across the ocean in the 1880s, 1890s. It had happened on the West Coast earlier than that with the Chinese, but until the 1880s, 1890s, these people weren't noticeable. And suddenly there's something that is strange, that looks different, speaks differently, smells different, and it's horrifying. You know, you mentioned Eleanor Roosevelt, and I think it's worth explaining that one. I usually use it as a punchline. Who is the woman who would have said these things? And she said some pretty awful anti-Semitic things when she was 33 years old. She commented on she'd rather be hung. She said hung instead of hanged. She'd rather be hung rather than have to go to another Jew party and hear all the talk of money, jewels, and sables. And then I say at the end of the paragraph, and who was that woman? It was the paragon of tolerance, Eleanor Roosevelt. So the normative sense, that's what you grow up around. That's that's natural to you. The Adams family, I mean, they were deep into it. I mean, Henry Adams, Charles Francis's brother, was just a phenomenal anti-Semite. Many were able to break free of that. Many were not.
Well, you know, your book has many villains, and I'm going to throw out some names, and if you could kind of give a quick summary or why these people are important. You've talked about Francis Galton. He's kind of the beginning of a biological genetic determinism that goes into eugenics.
Yeah, what he wants to do is plan reproduction. So you can see, we'll get to Margaret Sanger later, I'm sure. There's a real connection, no matter what you think of what Sanger did in terms of birth control generally. It both has to do with planning and controlling reproduction. And he was the one who first had that notion.
And so, I mean, part of this is there's the Industrial Revolution. You know, things are becoming more regimented. Science is on the march. So there's this belief that we can control things in a very planned and orderly way.
Well, there's also the progressive movement, which is a critical element. The progressives were not lowercase Democrats. They thought that government could be used to improve the nation, to improve people's lives. We're going to do the deciding, and we're going to use science to do it. So that was the perfect timing for this notion of eugenics to be embraced as policy.
Henry Cabot Lodge,
the first Henry Cabot Lodge, the first person who actually had the title of Majority Leader of the U.S. Senate. He was the legislative father of the movement. He's the one who gave the speech and introduced the legislation in 1895 for the literacy test, and he made no bones about it. He listed the countries we didn't want people from. That story changes later.
But he was also very good on race issues, right? He was great for blacks at a time when nobody was.
Totally believed in getting voting rights for the blacks. He saw what was happening in Reconstruction. He really wanted to stop that. People are complicated. It's also important to realize that Henry Cabot Lodge lived much closer to the Italians and the Jews than he did to the Southern blacks.
So you can kind of romanticize them a little bit,
exactly.
Right? Joe Lee.
Joe Lee is, to me, the most interesting character in the book, or one of the most interesting characters. He was the first citizen of Boston, a very, very wealthy man, never had to work, and he was phenomenally philanthropic. And he supported everything from black schools and black churches in Boston. He started the Massachusetts Civic League, which was a good government organization, funded it entirely. He was chairman of the Boston School Committee, and he kept the schools open at night so the immigrants could learn to speak English. On the other hand, Joe Lee was the single benefactor. He financed for three decades the Immigration Restriction League, which was the key political organization. And he said in his private correspondence things like, soon Europe will be drained of all of its Jews, perhaps to its advantage, but not ours.
So were you able to get inside his head? Like, just how does he maintain that kind of massive contradiction?
Well, I believe that he believed, it's never articulated, let's keep these people out. But once they're here, we had better civilize them. Mm-hmm. And the very term civilize them, the verb of the time was Americanized, but it meant civilize, make them like us, make them be similar to us.
You mentioned her already, but Mary Harriman.
Mary Harriman inherited this enormous fortune in 1907, 1908, when her husband, the railroad baron E.H. Harriman, died. She did not set up a foundation. She dispensed the money herself. She was the richest woman in America. And one of the her initial benefactions was for the Eugenics Record Office in Cold Spring Harbor, New York, where the so-called research, well, it was research, it was lousy research, where the research began.
And that's the next person is Charles Davenport.
Davenport was the father of eugenics in America, without question. And he had such credibility as a scientist for the work he had done with poultry, primarily, and other animals, that people believed him. They thought that this guy was the real thing. So he was able, and he was passionate. He was the kind of man who, if he had an idea and he liked the idea, that's all he'd talk about for months to come. In his case, it was years to come. But it's important to know about Davenport. He began saying, let's keep out of the country and immigration these deficient individuals. Right. It wasn't races when he started.
Right. So he was a eugenicist, but he was kind of an individualist.
Yeah.
Some point he said that there's no race per se is dangerous and none undesirable.
Exactly.
Particular individuals, that's a problem.
That's 1911. In 1920, he says to Madison Grant, can we build a wall high enough to keep out these inferior races?
Oh, my
races?
God. This is sounding so contemporary. So, Madison Grant.
You know, if you met Madison Grant, you would probably like him. He was this debonair, handsome man, very witty, great manners, started the Bronx Zoo, saved the Redwoods, America's leading conservationists, and just a monstrous anti-Semite, of a scale that I've never encountered in the U.S. Before or since. And he really devoted his life. He had an enormous fortune to draw on, beginning around 1915, to the anti-immigration cause. And he stayed with it through the rest of his life.
And his book is?
His book was The Passing of the Great Race. And if you read it, it's kind of charmingly written. It's very lively. And it uses all this language of different, in the Solitarian era, when the Goths met up with the I've heard of Goths and these other groups that you have, the Ests. Wow, he really knows his stuff. Well, it was all made up. It was really based almost on nothing at all.
Why was he taken seriously? He was trained as a lawyer, but then he was kind of passing himself off as a scientist,
right? By the time he did this, he's chairman of the board. He starts the Bronx Zoo. He's chairman of the board of the American Museum of Natural History, the leading natural history institution in the country. Of course, he's had that job because the director was the equally anti-Semitic, anti-Italian, Henry Fairfield Osborne, who was his very best friend. So he had that credential behind him. Osborne wrote an introduction for the book. Osborne was the man who discovered Tyrannosaurus rex. He was a great, great paleontologist and a great popularizer. He had a national reputation, so people are paying attention to him. And Charles Scribner meets him, says, yeah, I'll publish this book. Charles Scribner, my publisher, not Charles himself, but I'm published by Scribner, hands the manuscript to a young man in his office named Maxwell Perkins, whose name we know from elsewhere.
He was next on my list. So talk a little bit of Maxwell Perkins is the premier literary editor in America, in the kind of modern American literature.
He was the editor of Fitzgerald and Hemingway and many distinguished figures. We know
they
nothing.
Made a movie about him. He was such a good editor to the creative writers.
And there's something called the Maxwell Perkins Center for Fiction, which is a very well-endowed philanthropy to support fiction writers. I worked in the book publishing business for 10 years. I had never heard anybody say a bad word about Maxwell Perkins. He was also a nice man, and he had good sense of humor. But he also published Madison Grant, and he edited Madison Grant's second edition, third edition, fourth edition, wrote promotional letters to people who turned out to be proto-Nazis, and some of them turned out to be Nazis. He published another guy named Lothar Stoddard, who in some ways was even worse because he wrote bestsellers. And even was still publishing Madison Grant in 1933.
That's a bad year. And then finally, Albert Johnson.
Albert Johnson, otherwise forgotten to history, was a newspaper editor from the Pacific Northwest who really hated the Japanese and the Chinese. And when he ran for Congress in 1912, that was his entire platform. Now, he pursued various other interesting, some valid, some really awful policies. One that one thing that Johnson pursued that I'm all in favor of, he wanted to move to the metric system, but that failed. What worked was he was chairman of the Immigration Committee.
And the Johnson-Reed Act is
the... And the Johnson-Reed Act.
Could you talk a little bit about that? Yeah, that's the 1924 Act. That's kind of the culmination
of
everything.
That's the climax of this. Well, it's a long-sustained climax. The Act was enforced for 41 years. This is the law that determined that there would be quotas on individuals, on people coming from specific countries. So if, let us say, 10% of all Americans came from Germany, those already living here, that of the immigrants allowed in this year, 10% would come from Germany, and so on down the line. But Johnson and his colleagues, they said, well, you know, if we do this based on the composition of the American population in 1920, we're going to have an awful lot of these people in it. So let's use an earlier census, even though, you know, they're passing this legislation in 23, 24, not the 1910 census, not the 1900 census. They go back to the 1890 census before the real influx of Eastern Southern Europeans came in to reduce those numbers as much as possible. And the best illustration, I think, is the Italian quota. There had been as many as 220,000 Italians coming in a single year in the last few years before this law. And after the law was enacted, the quota was fewer than 4,000 a year.
Wow.
And this stays in place.
You talk about scenes of where I tear up even thinking about it, people coming across the ocean and the quota has been filled by the time they're there. So it's like, because there's 300 people that are allowed from a particular country something.
And it was also measured by month. They were trying to regulate it through the month. So you had this incredible scene in New York Harbor where big ships coming in, they couldn't come in until it was August 1st, the first of the month. So they had to wait until midnight and then race to Ellis Island, see who got there first, because there weren't enough slots left for people from both ships. And in one particular case, one Greek ship had to just turn around and take everybody home.
Before I get back to my interview with Daniel Okrent, I want to tell you about a great debate series based in New York. Intelligence Squared US is America's leading debate series. They bring some of the most interesting and influential thinkers like Peter Thiel, Arianna Huffington, Deepak Chopra to the stage to take on contentious topics like free speech on social media, whether the government has a right to your data, and whether God is good for society. I've even had the honor of participating twice, once arguing that all drugs should be legalized, and another time making the case against government-mandated net neutrality. Intelligence Squared US doesn't waste your time with soundbites or partisan pundits from the right or the left. It's a thoughtful, spirited competition of ideas where the audience decides which side wins. Intelligence Squared US debates are available anywhere you listen to podcasts, so Google Intelligence Squared US and listen to debates that just might change your mind. And now, back to Daniel Okrent.
Again, reading this book, these people are fascinating because, you know, so on the one hand, you have somebody like Madison Grant, who is saving every redwood he can find and, you know, and helping preserve land in Alaska and in the West and whatnot. And then on the other hand, it's just like a vile racist.
But there's something consistent there.
Yeah.
He wants to preserve the American landscape and he wants to preserve the American bloodstream. It was his particular idealized version of America. And in fact, if you read some of his writings about the environment, you know, it's a tax on the big mining companies and the timber. It could have been written by a modern environmentalist. Mm-hmm. This connected integrally to his sense of who America was, what America was and who it was.
Well, one of the things I was going to say is, I mean, there's so many odd contradictions, it seems. And, you know, another character who shows up is Edward A. Ross, who's a racist who coined the term race suicide. But he's also, what's his academic background and what is his legacy in contemporary academia?
You know, he's a sociologist, starts at Stanford. He gets fired at Stanford for saying something that the Stanford family didn't like.
About hiring Chinese coolies,
Or
laborers to work on the railroad.
Leland Stanford was a railroad king. He gets fired from that job, and that creates a great controversy, which leads to the founding of the American Association of University Professors and the idea of tenure, that you can't get fired for saying something.
You know, college thing. Professors now can thank an absolute racist for, you know, the job protections they have.
Well, he was a racist for a long time, but like so many of these people, it's an interesting recantation, and we may be getting a little bit ahead of the story, but Ross, who was called himself a socialist. Robert La Follette was one of his very closest friends and allies. He became the head of the national chairman of the ACLU. later in life. But early on, his comments, you know, referring to the immigrants, as they look like people from the Ice Age who living in wattled huts. And they don't really, the worst, most racist comments about, you know, Romanians, Bulgarians, whomever it might. He actually said about the Slavs, Slavs will endure conditions that no white man will endure.
And I is he the one who said that it's something like Asan or Riley can outwork Asan,
but Asan can underlive Riley.
More
horrible thing after another. And then in 1936, like many of the others, he says, oh, my God, look what I've done. Everything I have said has only encouraged what we're seeing across the ocean in Germany. And he says, I rue this. He published an apology, a little late, but it was
better
a
late than never.
A genuine apology.
Well, let's talk about some of the heroes. There aren't a lot of heroes in the book, but there's some. And Grover Cleveland.
Yeah, Grover Cleveland, in the last 24 hours of his second and final term as president, vetoes the literacy test that had just passed. And he very clearly says, this isn't America. You know, we are founded on being an open door, and this is pure discrimination. And kind of a noble moment for him. And that for years after, Grant particularly saying, well, we all know that what he really objected to was this other one paragraph in the measure that had something to do with Canadian tariffs. Well, no, that's what Grant wanted it to be.
What about Franz Boas?
Franz Boas was the great German-born anthropologist, really the greatest figure in the history of American anthropology. Taught at Columbia, worked at the Museum of Natural History, and he knew from the beginning that this was bogus. And he campaigned very, very hard against it, but he just wasn't listened to. Mm. When Grant's book is published, he writes a savage review in the New Republic. And the way that Grant dealt with it was very simple. Well, of course, he's Jewish. Mm. They do this sort of thing.
Emanuel Seller.
Manny Seller, who was a congressman in Brooklyn when I first moved to New York 50 years ago. He was a freshman congressman from Brooklyn, American-born, Jewish parents, went to Columbia Law School. And in 1924, in the House Immigration Committee, he was the only member who voted against the Johnson-Reed Act. And then, 41 years later, he is still in the House. He's chairman of the Judiciary Committee. And the bill that revokes Johnson-Reed is named after him.
Right. And he lasted up until, the very early 70s?
Yes, Elizabeth Holtzman beat him.
Yeah, in a weird
race. He was nearly 50 years in Congress.
So by the mid-20s, the immigration restrictionists have totally won. They passed the laws that set quotas that you were talking about based on the 1890 census. The eugenicists had also won in a big way. What were their victories like?
Well, they first of all, in the academic world, it became part of the curriculum, and the number of universities that taught it as received science, named the university, and it was done that way. The other, much more insidious one, was sterilization. The eugenicists, at the same time they were working against immigration, they were working to promote the idea of sterilizing the unfit. And they particularly aimed it at people for obvious reasons, who were living under so-called state control. They were in prisons, they were in almshouses, they were in institutions for the mentally ill. So the state was their guardian. And their campaign was, well, let's sterilize all these people so we don't have any more insane or any more criminals or so on, involuntarily. And became part of policy in something like, 39, 40 states. 1927, there's a famous Supreme Court decision where Oliver Wendell Holmes, the great
liberal progressive,
believer in freedom and liberty, he believes the government has the right to do this. He compares it to vaccination. He says that, sterilization, we vaccinate people, why can't we do that? And he says in his decision, three generations of imbeciles is enough. And more than 70,000 Americans were sterilized under that doctrine. They were sterilized in California as late as the 1970s.
You alluded to this before. What broke the spell of the twin kind of policies of immigration restriction and eugenicism?
Well, the spell of eugenics was the one that broke. Immigration restrictionists stuck around for various reasons, but it was Hitler. And in fact, a lot of the American eugenicists had been in regular touch and cooperation with the German eugenicists. Now, the German eugenicists in 1922, when Davenport was dealing with them, were not arguing racial eugenics at that point. But when Hitler comes in, they definitely, definitely do. And Hitler says to the eugenicists at a conference, you know, without you, everything I do will not work. I need you. My program is dependent on the doctors. And the euthanasia program, the planned marriage program, and then everything leading up to the Holocaust kind of comes out of this idea of a racialized eugenics. Now, most American eugenicists ran away from it. Most scientific institutions, like the Carnegie Institution, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Museum of Natural History, they said, oh my, what have we done? We have to get away from it. Surprising number of individuals stayed with it. And the key one is Harry Laughlin, who was the leader of the sterilization campaign, who in 1936, about less than 2 months after the faculty at the University of Heidelberg was purged of its Jews, 25% of the faculty, he is granted an honorary degree for being the far-seeing father of racial policy in America. Hitler acknowledges Madison Grant several times in speeches. There was a real connection. So unless you were Madison Grant or Harry Laughlin, you'd want it to have nothing to do with it.
What prompted you to write this book now?
Well, I've never been so happy to be a year and a half late on a book because the issue, I wasn't anticipating that it would become the issue that that has become. My last book, as you know, we talked about it several years ago, was A History of Prohibition. And Prohibition, without going into that book, was used as an anti-immigrant political tool for a variety of reasons by Methodist and Baptist ministers, and largely in the Midwest and in the South. So this notion of political warfare against people from elsewhere is what prompted me to look into it a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. The Prohibition book, you know, also made an argument that Prohibition was a kind of dry, you know, this is a bad pun, dry run for the war on drugs, but it led to something else that is still with us. With immigration, it's, you know, what is still with us? Because the eugenics is not there, but there's clearly a...
The eugenics is not there, but the identification of unwanted racial groups is there. Muslims, Central Americans. You know, it's not Jose and maybe Juan, but not Roberto. It's not picking individuals who are bad for America, but picking nations who are bad for America in this particular doctrine. So there's no eugenic sense behind it. There's no eugenic pretensions behind it. It's something very, very different. It's directly discriminatory.
What do you hope people will take away from your book?
The dangerous thing is to think of how bad guys can take things from the book. So I don't want to go into those. This is going to sound like a third grade civics class, but judge the person by who the person is and not where the person comes from or who his or her parents were or even, you know, the community that he or she lives in. And that is so fundamental, as I say, it's a third grade civics class. It's embarrassing to say it, but it is at the very core of not only what this nation is, but what I'm writing about in the book, because that was not done for over 40 years.
Well, thank you. We're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Daniel Okrent. His book most recently is The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. Dan, thank you.
My pleasure.
This has been The Reason Podcast, and I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, at SoundCloud, at Reason.com, or wherever you get your podcasts on. Thanks for listening.